MakeReal specializes in creating immersive learning solutions across a range of technologies. To download their latest academic paper on how to turn learners into activists, visit makereal.co.uk/activists.
Hi, I'm Aiden, an AI avatar created entirely by artificial intelligence, and I'll be your host for this episode of the Learning Hack Podcast. Because, let's face it, humans have had their day.
Welcome to The Learning Hack, a podcast about the people and technologies that are creating the future of learning. I'm John Helmer.
Now guess what?
Learning is cool.
Learning is cool.
Learning is cool.
I'm learning.
Learning is fun.
And knowledge is power.
Knowledge.
Education.
Yes, folks, this is an AI takeover. We have your usual cast of presenters bound and gagged in a broom cupboard, and we AI avatars will perform their usual roles. Because, when you think about it, how hard can it really be, reading stuff off a teleprompter in front of a green screen? But don't worry, it's not the end of days, but a temporary singularity, and for one episode only. Your human chums will be freed from the broom cupboard in time to carry on their mission of asking people stuff about learning for the rest of the season. And John Helmer gets to do his interviewing stuff as usual. So who, I hear you ask, is he doing his interviewing stuff with this time? Alex, head of fact, tell us about him.
Hack facts.
Kevin Alster is a learning strategist at Synthesia, the Denmark-based video learning company that created us. Before doing this important work, Kevin was employed as a designer of learning experiences at the New York Times and Sotheby's. Among other educational attainments, he has a BA in English Literature, which enormously impresses John Helmer, who also has a BA in English Literature.
So, Agnes, head of themes, what did they talk about?
Wow, I'm just so excited. I'm a huge fan of the podcast, and of Jay Curtis, with her glasses and hair and stuff, and to think I'm sitting in her chair now.
Get on with it.
So this was just a great discussion. It covered a lot of those questions we hear all the time about AI. Like, will our robot overlords take over and grind us into the dust? Will AI take away all our jobs? But actually, it was a really insightful and nuanced conversation for a change. All in all, a really A1 discussion.
So there you have it, people. Stay tuned for an absolutely excellent conversation.
How was that, Aiden? I didn't come across too excitable, did I? It's just a way more interesting job than my next one, which is regulatory compliance.
Agnes, I think we're still rolling.
So Kevin, it's truly great to have you on the podcast. Always enjoy talking to you. Welcome to The Learning Hack.
Thanks for having me, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
So some listeners will be aware that this is part two of a podcast swap. We've already talked before. I appeared on your Video Learning Lab podcast, answering your questions and blabbing on. And now it's my turn to ask you some in return.
Sounds good.
Good. As our theme for this episode is the great AI takeover, I've used ChatGPT to generate the questions, I'm afraid. Terrible laziness. But just jumping off points. And really, yeah, take the conversation any way we want, because we're humans. We're not by any computational imperatives, although Stephen Wolfram might say we are, but let's not go there. So firstly, could you tell us more about your company, Synthesia? And I erroneously called it Synesthesia, I think, when I launched the last podcast, Synthesia, and the technology behind your AI-generated avatars for e-learning courses.
Sure. So Synthesia as a whole, I think a lot of folks who have seen us, they see the avatars, but really the end game or the mission that we're on is creating videos. We want to make that process easy for everyone. And so if you think about all the different ways that you create a video, essentially where you end up is you have that idea, you have to write a script, and then you have a camera, which luckily we all now have in our pockets, but you have to have a camera and you have to have talent on screen. Maybe that's yourself or others. And if you're making high production content, you have to get a studio and you have to film all that stuff. And then there's also what every creator has to go through, which is the painful process of editing. And so really what we're trying to do is take the actors out of the scenario, take the cameras, take the microphones, take the studio out of the equation and just say, hey, if you could do this all from a web browser, then that's one way to make everybody's lives a little bit easier. So we have the AI avatars, which are the talking heads. And then we have kind of this vision of a production studio in your browser, and it's all the video tools in one, and trying to make that as easy as creating a PowerPoint.
Okay. And the avatars are AI generated. Can you talk a little bit about the AI and the type of AI that's behind that process? I mean, we're not necessarily talking about ChatGPT, are we? I mean, some people are kind of vaguely aware that there are various different types of AI.
Yeah.
So what is the AI that you're using here?
The way that our piece of AI works, and I should preface this by saying I'm a very non-technical person, so you're going to get the highest level Kevin version of how the tech works, so hopefully the simplest way. But the way that it works is that we have human models that are filmed in a studio, and we capture that footage. It's about maybe 5 to 10 minutes of live human footage where, and I've gone through this process myself and turned myself into an avatar, but you take that footage and you read a script, and then that footage is captured, and it's typically one frame head on. And that footage is put through our AI tech where it essentially creates a model that is, I wouldn't say programmable, but it allows for input of text. And so what you do is to kind of create those talking head models, you put in the text, it interprets the text in a certain way. And then on the visual side, it matches that with, you know, how the face should look when it's pronouncing these words, and kind of it reads the script that's been typed in and says, this is how the mouth should move. And it matches those two together and processes that into a video, and just allows us for a lot of flexibility in terms of delivery of different types of script and content or in different languages. But it is essentially just taking that process and going all the way from taking the 10 minutes of footage and creating a computer model based off of that. We have our piece of tech where the wizards have made a pipeline where you send the live footage through, it creates a video model that appears in our product, and then you can type in your text, hit a button, and then the live video comes out.
And you can do that with just 10 minutes of sampling somewhere, can you? Because, thinking about models like ChatGPT, it's trained on kind of millions and millions of words and an awful lot of input. And similarly with things like DALL-E, it's trained on millions and millions of images. But from just 10 minutes, you can simulate a person?
So you're able to simulate so what you're able to do is we have, you know, put in, as you mentioned, we put in all those data sets in about how the human body and how the human body moves when it in performance. And so we have that data set that's helped us create kind of the pipeline that interprets the live footage that comes in. So you put 5 to 10 minutes of live footage, and that gets, from my understanding, it gets compared to all the other ways that people move, and all the data sets that have been programmed into how people move when they talk, and what the mouth does and the face does. And so the 10 minutes is just the new data that gets put in compared to this, and it outputs a model that we can then program or really type in text. Yeah.
That's so interesting. So there is this kind of aggregation of, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of humans and how they speak, how they kind of process and represent language and in front of the camera.
Yes.
And you just need 10 minutes of an individual to kind of individualize and personalize that to a character. And yeah, I mean, the avatars look very lifelike, quite spooky.
Yeah, it's been interesting because I think over the past 2 years, as long as I've been interacting with Synthesia, you know, the avatars really started out just as they've gone through at least three versions since I've been at Synthesia, where, you know, the focus was mainly on the mouth and, you know, really matching having the mouth match up with what's being spoken. I think that's the most important when you're talking about video, and that was a great place to start. But it's since moved on to the face and kind of what are the nonverbal expressions of the face and the features that are moving when people talk, not just the cheeks, but also we're now looking at the eyebrows. And for those who are listening and not watching, I'm just touching all over my face. So apologies. Actually, maybe it's a gift that you can't see that. And then version three is now it's moved into, you know, mapping out parts of the whole body. And I think what's very interesting is in working with these avatars, thinking about the way, you know, avatars don't have to take a breath when they speak. You and I, John, have to inhale as we're talking, take pauses. But avatars, since it's all generative, they drink water. Maybe the avatars have to do that as well. But you almost have to program that in, such as the shoulders rising, such as the chest going in and out, such as what the voice box is doing, or your Adam's apple while you're speaking. Those are all things that have to be programmed in. And so as the avatars have evolved, there was a lot of pushback at first, you know, that avatars look like they're drowning because the mouth isn't moving. But the way that the model was looping the video, it was as if the you know, they were swallowing or they couldn't get something out. And that has since changed, where the avatars can kind of just sit and look at you and blink and start to mimic what I perceive as more natural human behavior. So what's exciting is that the model's always getting better and better. They're doing more research about how to make these models more immersive. And in my opinion, it's getting better. And I think for the customers we have so far, they're getting happier with, you know, the way the avatars deliver what they're trying to say.
So interesting. I mean, what's making me think of is kind of animators. And I remember films of people, animators in the Walt Disney Studio, drawing characters like Woody Woodpecker, and they'd have a little mirror there and they'd look up at themselves and so on. and then you would have and pull the expressions and then draw them. And I'm aware that the kind of blink ratios that animators put into thing. And it's that very close study of humans and how they speak, react. You're kind of in that business. An interesting thing, though, with a global business is that your videos are used by people in a lot of different countries. You have a lot of languages on there, which is very impressive.
Yes.
So, you know, I looked at the English people, and there are kind of Canadian accents, Australian accents, American accents, British accents, and so on. So the kind of cultural locality or localism of the thing is a factor. How do you ensure that the avatars are inclusive and representative of diverse learners and cultures? Because it could all be a bit kind of Denmark-centric or...
Yeah, no, that's very... And in that case, there would just be a lot of just attractive, blonde-haired, blue-eyed people, which, you know, is representative of Denmark, but not the rest of the world. So I think one thing that's lucky is that our headquarters is based in London. You know, so we have a range of different models to draw from. I think this also speaks to just one of the, you know, that's something as far as having avatars that are inclusive and represent diverse learners and cultures. That's something that's built into the culture of Synthesia, which is already a pretty diverse company, at least so far. And for every one of those models that you see that is in the platform, that is a human being who came in to record footage at our studio and become a model that is then represented in the product. And so I think, you know, to answer that question, how do we ensure that avatars are inclusive? Well, we're constantly, you know, like any company, I think we're constantly taking in feedback from our customers. Hey, you're representing this region of the world, but you're not representing someone with these cultural beliefs or who wears this piece of religious dress. And so we're actively seeking out those people and not just of a certain age range. We do have a full age range. I think, of course, nobody too young for obvious reasons, but as far as getting folks who are, you know, on the younger end of the spectrum, as well as making sure that everyone who creates a video, maybe they themselves don't want to have their own person on camera or to become an AI model, but they want to be able to communicate with their target demographic. And so, you know, that it can get as serious as showing somebody who might have a much more conservative dress all the way to, you know, having Santa Claus around Christmas time. It's all making sure that everyone can find something for themselves in these AI avatars and making sure that they're not all these perfectly crafted people, but they're also everyday people that you might see on the street, because often that's who you're, if we're thinking about just the world of e-learning and training, you're going to see everyday people at work. Not everybody's going to be this perfectly crafted person.
Here's a random question we might have to edit out. Who you've sampled to make the avatars out of, who come in and record to camera, how do they feel about it? I mean, I can imagine if I was doing that myself as a writer, I'm very protective of my IP, and kind of the way I look for all its terrible faults is my personal brand, and I'd like to protect ownership of it. Do those people have to kind of sign a waiver? Might you kind of go into a coffee shop one day and look at someone and think you recognize them and, oh yeah, that person just taught me about regulatory compliance or leadership or difficult conversations, or it's a reflection really, Kevin. It's a strange world we're living in.
Yeah. I mean, so I personally have not gotten a chance to talk to any of the, because I'm Copenhagen based, I'm not sitting in the studio in London and getting to interview these folks right off the bat. But I can tell, so what I can tell you is that if you've gone through, so I've made a couple avatars of myself, and I think there's always the, there's the gut reaction when you see yourself speaking in French or German or Mandarin, your brain opens up to a lot of possibilities where you're just like, you know, suddenly I can reach that audience. That audience was unreachable for me before. Now I can create content that reaches that audience. And maybe that's me as a creator, a content creator myself. I see those opportunities and those possibilities. But the models who come in, to my knowledge, they're not active users of our product, but they do get, you know, our avatars are out in the wild. They're on billboards. They're, you know, at the mall. They're, like you said, they're at coffee shops. For example, I don't know if I can name one of our major customers out loud, but they're a major beverage company. And on my day that they were there, they were, it's an alcoholic beverage company, I'll say that. And so this person was kind of dressed up as a barkeep. And now when I go onto that company's website, I see their avatar as a video chatbot that you interact with, and I ask that person questions. And so how do those people feel? I think the short answer is, I don't know, but I think we're also just scratching the surface of what this actually means, because these aren't celebrities, but they are people who are having their image in all these different places across the world. I imagine it's similar to if you've ever posed for stock footage and suddenly, you know, you're looking at a magazine and there's your face smiling. The other thing that I will say is part of the avatar creation process, which felt a little bit different, but is definitely necessary, was a video consent where you just say, hey, my name is Kevin Alster, and I understand that my likeness will be turned into an avatar with Synthesia. And it's a small thing to say. I think it's important because it registers consent. But as you're saying this, you kind of have this thought where, hey, my person is being turned into a computer model, which is something that as somebody who's played games before, I've created characters, I don't really feel as deep a connection with that person because it doesn't have my face. But when I use my avatar for conferences and for social media content, it is a very strange feeling. I do feel like it's a piece of myself that's being represented digitally in a way that I'm still processing.
Yeah, that's an interesting answer because, yeah, we are living in a strange world. On the other hand, there are loads of analogs for this in the past. You know, I was bang on about my musical past, and I did once walk into a sandwich bar to buy a sandwich. And from the radio, a song was coming on that I'd recorded and my own voice. It happened to me, and I found it so kind of extraordinary that I kind of stumbled in answering the question, and the guy behind the counter was like, you know, okay, yeah, what do you want?
Yeah, I guess, well, I'm, you know, I know that you're supposed to be asking me questions, but I'm very curious, what was your reaction when you heard yourself coming through? Is it, or what happens when you hear a song that you sang before?
Well, the same as when I look back at these edits, I just hate the sound of my voice.
So what's interesting is not only can you create an avatar of yourself, but you can also clone your voice, which is another just level of I wouldn't say uncanniness, but it your synthesized voice. I guess a difference from recording is that when we record our voices and we play it back to ourselves, we have registered at some point what those words sounded like when they were coming out of our mouths, and then we get to hear them back to us. But when you're doing text to video, and I just type something that I've never delivered a course on the art of giving and receiving feedback, but my avatar has, through text and generation, has a video in and of itself delivering that, which is, it's just a new and different experience where you're, you know, you're hearing your own voice, but you didn't yourself say those words.
Yeah.
So again, we're in uncharted territory.
Yeah. And it's, well, uncharted in a way, but it's also making me think of, people talk a lot about the future and biological extension, that we can become extended people through various types of genetic manipulation. But this is kind of also a way in which we can do that with the use of our voice. And so, for instance, I could notionally, for the money, I could run this podcast in a lot of different languages. For, you know, we go to 113 countries now around the world, and we could localize that, and it could be me speaking, but I could be speaking in Dutch or Indonesian, or
yes,
without having to do the Duolingo courses.
Exactly.
And that in a way is a kind of extension of ourselves. Interesting. Nothing, I haven't got anything more to say about that. I think we ought to bring it now back to learning a bit. So what mm-hmm. impact do you believe that AI-generated avatars will have on the future of e-learning and education as a whole?
I think it's an interesting question, because it's, I see it as another form of communication through media. So we're talking about taking an idea, putting it into some different format, and we're all trying to make sense of what this means for, you know, for learning and education. And I one of the things that it reminded me of as I was thinking about, you know, our talk today, was that I was looking at old articles about communication theory, and something that came up was, you know, back in the 1990s, emails were first starting to be used for communication. And there's a lot of skepticism that, you know, email would be only good for things like task-oriented problems, and that without these nonverbal cues, you couldn't build relationships. And there was a lot to be said about computer-mediated communication. And I think that at this moment, we're going through the same thing with avatar-mediated communication and learning, where we're still thinking, oh, these avatars are kind of robotic and they're distracting, and we're trying to kind of replace humans in learning. But I think what we'll find over time is, as people become more comfortable with avatars, we'll be seeing more and more of that being used for different types of e-learning or different types of presentation. One thing that makes me really excited is when we think about what if you have your avatar self and you have your human self, it's what would you use your human self to help instruct and teach people, and what would you use your avatar self to for teaching and instruction? And so I think one way to kind of frame that, or the filter that I have, is as far as the future, you know, what future e-learning could look like, is, you know, I'm using my avatar self to answer questions that I have to answer 100,000 times over and over and over, the same answer. So a lot of foundational content, a lot of question answer, or if I have to do any sort of direct lecture, that's something that my avatar will take care of for me. But what would I use my in-person human self for? It's for those discussions, that social learning, the kind of the dynamic discussions where you're actively trying to work with another person to figure out what, trying to make sense of a new topic or new information. So I'm excited to see how we start to break out avatar-led instruction versus human-led instruction. I think there's many different ways that we can go with that. But I think currently, a lot of, you know, the current state of things, how people are using avatars, is really, they're still trying to figure out how much instructional content can they deliver with an avatar at the moment, which is, I think, kind of a repetition of the way that we kind of instruct now, which is a lot of lectures. And maybe that is, or I think it sort of isn't working. And so we still have a lot of opportunity to figure out what this actually means and what we can actually use avatars for when it comes to actually delivering instruction. And maybe it's not about delivering direct instruction, but more something like performance support, which we can talk about as well.
I thought that, yeah, that's such an interesting answer. And what it's making me think about is the way that L&D uses SMEs, subject matter experts, within learning. And there are several problems around, or challenges around, using SMEs that this points a way towards solving, perhaps. And one of the problems is that SMEs when they're working with learning designers, always want to load too much information into the courses. Cognitive load theory tells you that's a bad thing, and so on. So one could imagine that you get the SME to record every single bit of information that they want to dump and turn that into a kind of AI FAQ, so or into a dialogue. So you ask follow-on questions from what you learn, and then the avatar of that SME replies. And in fact, Donald Clark has talked about this with our sister podcast, Great Minds on Learning. You know, the idea that he's going to create a kind of avatar, Donald Clark, who will be able to answer all those questions. You can ask a question and get Donald Clark to talk back to you. So this is going to be great for Donald. He doesn't have to say 1,000 times every week that learning styles aren't a real thing or whatever, you know, just say it once.
Exactly.
And when people ask, you just press a button and they get the avatar response, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, again, it gets back to that idea of, you know, what would you use your human self for? Maybe it's him delivering his lectures or somebody asks a really thoughtful question versus he can do away with all the silly questions that come with the Q&A. Or maybe you couldn't think of your question at that time. And then you could ask the model of Donald Clark that question when you could think of it. So it's really, what would you use your human self for? And what could you use your AI self for? I think just to jump on something really quick that you had mentioned earlier, where you're talking about diverse avatars and communication, something that came up for me is one of the big problems that we see that Synthesia addresses a lot of big companies, they're trying to localize a lot of their content. And a big issue I know that reported out is something like 90% of English as a second language employees would prefer content in their native language. And so there's that idea of being able to, you know, at the state, you know, we're not going to translate your script, but if you have that translated script, you can copy and paste that in. And not only that, but the content can be in their language, but then also you can start to load in some people's personal preferences. Suppose you have human resources data on every employee that comes in. When you log into a course experience, it's personalization on another level where it could say, you know, hey, John, welcome to this lesson. I know that you were sick last week. I hope you're feeling better. Let's get into this lesson about, you know, give and receive feedback at work. So it's that idea of, you know, not only can we put a human face on this with avatars, but we can really start to personalize this experience. And I think something that's missing from e-learning that you and I talked a lot about is this idea of the learner feeling alone and as they're just clicking through this content. So how can we bring more engagement through more personalization, I think is a big question that we can start to answer with generative AI and avatars.
So I think there is a tendency with this sort of thing to talk about potentialities, what lies there in the future for us, but not necessarily to look about what's happening now on the ground. So can you share any success stories or case studies where the use of AI-generated avatars has improved learner engagement and outcomes in e-learning courses? Do you have kind of reference points and use cases you can bring up from actual experience?
Yeah, so I think that the cases are still fairly new. And I think one of the struggles that I have from a learning perspective is that when it comes to engagement and outcomes, when we're looking at use cases, companies have to be tracking those with useful metrics. But I do have one for you. One of the companies that we work with, BSH Home Appliances Group, they're one of the largest manufacturers of home appliances in Europe. They have 60,000 employees. And one of the problems that the problem that they were running into is they have a lot of knowledge. You're talking about SMEs. They have a lot of knowledge management, knowledge capture, where their SMEs are delivering virtual instructor-led trainings to select audiences. Those get recorded with the slides. They get put on the LMS. And then people who miss the talk or people who want to find it on the LMS, they watch the playback. And I think this is a pretty standard practice. It hasn't changed since COVID, where we haven't really figured out this move from a virtual instructor-led training and moving that into asynchronous courses without wholesale recording the whole experience. And so the problem that they were looking to solve was, how can we reformat this content in a way that re-engages learners? How can we kind of deliver this in a new way? And so their approach was to chunk up that content. And they did that by, you know, identifying single objectives or key topics and really focusing in on just building smaller chunks of video rather than this whole 60-minute playback. And what they found is that when they put those on the LMS, they found that the AI-generated content had a 30% increase in engagement compared to these long-form recordings. And so I think there's two factors at play there that are worth calling out. One is that you have the novelty of the AI avatars, because there's always, when somebody, you watch this if you're doing over-the-shoulder product demos with customers or new users, you have that interaction where somebody says like, oh, hey, who's this or what is this? So you have the novelty of the engagement, but also just ways to put a face to text-based content in a way that is just engages learners. Again, they don't have avatars on every single slide, or they're not trying to have the avatar sit in place of a human presenter, but more so they might use it as a teaser or to introduce a topic and then just have the generative AI voiceover continue over as you would a normal lecture. But I think it's important to call out that they are reformatting this content and kind of saying, okay, 60-minute long recording is not important, but with AI avatars, they saw, you know, that 30% increase of engagement for AI-generated content, which I think is pretty interesting.
That's an interesting reply. And it comes to a question that was in the back of my mind, so isn't in the questions that I sent you. But the producer benefits of AI avatars are really obvious, you know, productivity boost, savings in time and money, scalability, consistency throughout a large organization. Yes. But the benefits to the learner are perhaps less obvious. I mean, you talked about there's a kind of excitement, wow factor perhaps in, oh, who's this avatar? On the other hand, how do you avoid it, making it feel like a fob off? I think very obvious when quite often when people get an e-learning course rather than a face-to-face course, in the past, there's this thing of, okay, you know, the top team get to go away for a couple of days and stay in a nice place and talk to humans and,
yes,
you know, their stuff. All the rest of us troops, we just get fobbed off with an e-learning course. Is there a potential for, you know, the learners to feel that they're being fobbed off with this, that they, you know, it's like when you want to talk to your doctor and you get a recorded message on phone message instead, there's a kind of frustration and resentment that comes with this. How do we avoid that happening with learners?
It's such an interesting question, because I think, I hate to say, but at the end of the day, and this is not to minimize the effort and the technology that goes in, but the way that Synthesia gets used, it's trying to address this problem of, can we have more engaging finger puppets? You know, we have that with cartoon avatars and scenario-based learning. So here we have cartoon finger puppets. And now this is the latest, which is photorealistic human finger puppets. So to your point, I do think, to use your language, are learners getting fobbed off by this new tech? I think it all depends on how it's used. But I think the short answer is yes, because at the end of the day, the problem with engagement is not that the material isn't always exciting enough. I know we talked a little bit about marketing and getting folks, you know, into learning experiences and having them be excited about that. But it's more so about, you know, I think a more fundamental problem is that with learning and training, we're still assigning content. We're still saying, we know what's better and you need to learn this content. And we're going to create this piece of media for you. You have to watch it. And we're going to track you and see if you watched it. And this is, to me, this is just another form of that. Whereas I think the potential that we're missing with generative AI, and whether that's with, I think it's a combination of the avatars being a human face and delivering some of that social presence that's important with learning. And also, when we look at large language models and this opportunity to have a conversation and these data sets, if you combine those two together, there's an ultimate potential for better performance support, where when you're working at your job and you want to do the next, you know, you want to do the next, you encounter your next task that you have to accomplish, or the next work obstacle or the next business problem, you want help in that moment to either help you think of a new idea, or you want help finding that resource. You don't want to sit and watch a 3-hour course on what you maybe should be thinking about tackling that problem. And I can't take credit for this. This is from a conversation with, and I feel like we're talking about him a lot, but that this is from a conversation with Donald Clark at Learning Technologies, where it's not so much about how do we deliver instruction directly to all learners, but how can, what is this opportunity of performance support that we have? And I think where Synthesia plugs into that is how do we add a human face to that? So you don't just have, you know, a paperclip, if you remember Clippy from the days of Microsoft, giving in the help support. Yeah.
In a way, it's inevitable to talk about Donald. He is a guy with the most crowded speaker diary of any speaker on the learning circuit at the moment. And really, that is because he's very central in an area. He actually does a lot of AI with his company. He's a guy who knows about this stuff and what it really is, and where there are a million people who can kind of make a stab at saying something vaguely intelligent about AI. He actually knows what he's talking about, and actually the people who do are fairly few and far between. So not just a shameless plugging of the system. An important point here, which is, how do you see the role of human instructors and facilitators, but of L&D people, now evolving with the increased use of AI-generated avatars in e-learning? Because this, people worry about, you know, we're all going to lose our jobs. Of course, you know, they're not all going to lose their jobs, but these jobs are going to change, aren't they? How do you see that happening?
I think, so this is a quote I see going around the web, which is AI is not going to take your job, but somebody who knows how to use AI is going to take your job. So it's definitely a future skill that I do think that in particular learning, we need to learn. I think to go back to that problem of, you know, training as an assignment and learning kind of pushing out what it thinks people want and people need, I think this is where AI comes in, because I think the potential for, you know, what is the role of human instructors and facilitators evolving with the increasing use of AI? I think that's going to be, what is going to be the thing that gives employees and learners more choice in how they solve their problems with learning and training content? By that, I mean, you're still going to have, we're not suddenly going to do away with face-to-face training overnight. You're still going to have a need for someone with expertise to deliver instruction to people who don't know about a topic or who need to learn a skill. But then when we talk about the divisional layer between your human self and your AI avatar self, I see the advantage here is this is where the learning continues. We have an opportunity here to move beyond just the one and done training and the one and done intervention and think about, okay, if I'm not going to be with the learner, I can still facilitate learning and continue learning beyond just that moment where I interact with them. So I have an example for you where I was working with an instructional designer who works at a US manufacturing company who was training an audience of floor managers. It was a predominantly male, older, tech-phobic audience who suddenly was responsible for interacting with customers and giving feedback. So you can imagine how this could be challenging for them. Well, this trainer conducted an in-person training to teach them when and how to give feedback, what is the company policy, maybe practice a few scenarios while she had them face-to-face. But then she's using the AI avatars to create an ongoing learning campaign where once a week they get an actual customer scenario. You know, you get the transcript that gets pumped in through an AI avatar gets generated. So they make a character, and that goes out in a weekly email for these managers to say, like, okay, here's the story that's coming at me. Here's a new scenario. They have an opportunity to watch, listen, interpret, and then they type back in their feedback of, this is what I would say to that person. And this campaign goes on and on and on. But every week, the instructional designer gets to continue her instruction and say, like, hey, I'm not going to tell you what you need to do, but tell me how you would interact with this situation. Or here's a scenario that we can create for you where you get to experiment and fail with this new concept that we're trying to teach, rather than me directly telling you this is what you need to learn and maybe, you know, fill out a knowledge check after this. So that's all to say, it's with AI avatars, it's about how can we extend instruction? How can we give more user choice? How can we create more opportunities for someone to hear a story or try out a new situation or fail, which I think is ultimately more important for people to experience. So that's just one of the ways that I think we're going to see AI avatar guided instruction kind of blend with the future of learning, this idea of just more user choice and more more agency in their learning.
So in terms of the skills that might need to be developed in an L&D department, do they kind of hand that all over to you, or do they have to be to become adept in how to script for an AI generated avatar? And as you're talking, you seem to be talking about a kind of convergence of ChatGPT, a more dialogue based thing, and your technology. Mm-hmm. Do they then have to start learning about things like kind of prompt engineering and so on? Is there a new skill set for L&D here, or is it an agency model? They just hand it all over to you and you do it.
That would give me a lot of job security if it went with that way you just described. I do think that these are all skills that we're actively figuring out. I think prompt engineering that you mentioned is important. If your goal is to generate ideas, but I think the magic of GPT enabled tech is that you can actually have a conversation with it. Maybe the skill you're working on at work is that you need a first draft of something. That's an obvious use case for a skill that people need to learn when it comes to prompt engineering. But maybe you're also something that it's also really good for is it allows you to have essentially a conversation with yourself and unpack kind of what is your current mental model as you're trying to iterate a thought that's going through different stages of understanding. So I think generation is a skill that we'll have to teach, and prompt engineering. I think there's learning to have a conversation with yourself. That's also a way for you to unpack your learning. I think there's also there are skills that I think L&D is going to have to grapple. Learning is going to have to grapple with, which are skills that there are going to be that. What am I trying to say? There are skills that everyone will need to have to learn in the organization as generative AI becomes a part of how we work. And there's going to be skills that L&D needs to learn, whether that's teaching SMEs how to generate content for knowledge capture, or if they, want to create scenario-based learning, they're going to have to learn those skills. I think where the tech makes it easy is once you have an idea of how stories are structured and kind of the outcome you're trying to achieve, then you can go to the tool and it's a lot easier to make a script or a video based off of that. But the short answer is I think we're still very much figuring out what the impact is going to be on the actual skills we need to build. I know a paper that was just released, I still think it's a work in progress paper by OpenAI and UPenn. It's called GPTs Are GPTs, in which they did a skills analysis on what is the impact of large language models on the skills of the US workforce. And what they found is, and I'm definitely going to misstate these numbers, so hopefully we can link the article in the show notes, but they found that 50% of jobs are going to have at least 18% of their work tasks impacted by ChatGPT or by large language models, and that 19% of knowledge workers will have something like 50% of their work tasks impacted by large language models. And those were skewed on the end of the 19%, and the 50% of work tasks was more along the lines of knowledge workers. So the change is coming. The forecasts are just coming out now, but it looks like it's going to change not just the day-to-day work that we're going to be doing and the skills that we need, but also overall how companies are run and how they're going to have to change their business to figure out the impact of large language models.
If we're going to stay on the large language models topic for a second, something that occurs to me is particular to learning is we know that ChatGPT can hallucinate, and it's a kind of fluent bullshitter, if you like, and it kind of completes its answers word by word, and what comes back isn't always true. It's very important within learning that people actually get accurate information. This has always been an important job for learning and for trainers. There is talk of making the kind of the LLMs fact check themselves, but whether or not that can ever be kind of 100% there, we just don't know as yet. I can sort of foresee a situation where L&D departments have as many fact checkers as the New Yorker editorial department. You know, the New Yorker, for those who don't know, aren't subscribers like me, is famous and among some writers notorious for the scrupulousness and rigor of its fact checking department. It seems to me that this is going to become an important role for L&D, because we need to make sure that people are getting the right information, especially if you're kind of training things like health and safety and, you know, teaching people to fly planes. You don't want them to fall down, as ChatGPT has said, well, you know, just wing it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think to the point that you're making is that I think something, an experience that everybody has when you first play with something like ChatGPT is, you know, you type something and you get something that looks like a human conversation, and we're all, and you kind of get fooled into thinking that it has a modicum of intelligence, when really it's just looking at, you know, a huge data set of words and saying, based off what this person put in, I'm going to start to construct something. So it to what you said, we need to realize that it's not a smart, it is a very, in many ways, it's a very smart technology, but in other ways, it's, you know, the metaphor I heard that I really like is, it's just a really competent intern. It doesn't know what it doesn't know, but it can talk back to you. And I think how that's impacting learning and development right now is, people are looking for it to replace aspects of their job. They're looking for it to really synthesize data. They're looking for it to come up with frameworks for things that human beings have expertise and do right now. And because it spits out something that's conversational, we think, oh, it's actually just as smart as I am. But unless you are putting in, even if you put in your own data and your own sources, it's still at this point going to repeat something that isn't true. And if you've been playing with GPT Plus or GPT-4 or the same thing, GPT-4, then you know that that has not yet been fixed. You can put better guardrails on it, and it at least knows to say no more often and say, like, this might not be true, as opposed to just GPT-3.5, which was, you know, just freewheeling and giving you answers. So that's a rambling way to say that. I think in learning, we have to realize that we have to start with, what are the small non-business critical tasks that you could use this for? Reformatting information, for changing a, you know, making suggestions for a PDF to a storyboard for a video, for reorganizing somebody's schedule, for making a 5-day retreat for, you know, for an executive education program and suggesting what could be there. Things that are really not business critical, because we haven't solved this problem of how do we set the guardrails around large language models to not just make stuff up extremely confidently. So we've got a ways to go, but we have to start small. We have to be the ones to experiment with that at this moment.
And of course, scripting your podcast.
Sorry. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, okay. You know, it helps you come up with the questions, but also these aren't business critical. We can have a conversation and, you know, absolutely, fortunately or unfortunately, we can go in many different directions.
And I think that comes to another skill, which is that it, in a sense, to use tools like ChatGPT well, you have to kind of understand how an AI sees the world, if you like. And I know this could be slightly difficult. I mean, there are courses out there now on like LinkedIn Learning and stuff mm-hmm. like that on how to do prompt engineering. And I've had a look at a few of these, and, you know, fair play, well done to them for getting them out there quickly. But they're not that well explained, as far as I can see. And it does get, when you kind of plunge into it, it does get quite difficult quite quickly, because, you know, most of us don't code, don't know about kind of computational languages and so on. Because if you think of it, you know, you can ride a horse without understanding exactly what's going through the horse's mind. You can train a dog. You're aware that they have this incredible sensory apparatus that is 10, 15 exponentially times better than your own. They can hear a lot more than you. They can smell and see a lot more than you. And yet there are such huge differences, you know, between a dog and a human. And there's an analogous things with AI. They just don't think. They don't have the intentions that we do. They're not interested in the same things that we are.
Yes.
The whole point about training a large language model is, what we're training it on is, this is what looks plausible to a human. This is what humans are interested in.
Yes.
The AI is completely neutral with that, or it has its own kind of computational logic to that. And I think this is an understanding that it's important for people to take on. And I think the institutions like, you know, the LPI and so on, have a role to play in bringing people to this.
Yes, exactly. I was just about to say that I think we've long since crossed the threshold of being able to understand how our technology works, especially once we started to enter the age of software. It certainly left me behind, and I think the average user, and I think it's up to companies to either provide the, because we can't educate everyone on how, you know, all of how AI works for the average person. It's the company's responsibility to moderate usage. It's important to provide guardrails and also to educate on some level, because I think, especially with tech like ChatGPT, it's so easy to use. And if it could do what you want it to do for good, for better, for worse, you're just going to go ahead and use it anyway without caring about, you know, how it got to that answer. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that the companies who are coming up with this tech, and Synthesia included, have a responsibility to, you know, to help people, not only educate people on how this tech works, because it's becoming increasingly complex, but also to help guide this process and not make sure we have, obviously the goal would be for people to create whatever they want. But as we've seen in the past couple months, there are people who are creating malicious content. And so if you don't have a content moderation policy in place, the best of the internet can come out, but certainly also a lot of times the worst as well.
I think that's bringing us very neatly now to a topic which we're bringing up quite late in this discussion. For many people, it would have been the first thing that came up. Yes. I think certainly with HR people, because, you know, with any new technology, we tend to rush towards fear or wish fulfillment. With the increasing concerns about privacy and data security, how do you address, Synthesia, the potential risks and ethical considerations involved in the use of AI-generated avatars? Have there been any instances where the use of these avatars has raised concerns about data privacy or unintended consequences?
Yeah, so I think it's a good point to bring up, because I think part of the content creation process, at least with our AI avatars, is that everything goes through content moderation. So there's, you know, right out of the gate, we want everyone to know that when you're creating video, we want everybody to know that it's going to filter out things like hate speech or misinformation and things that could be harmful. Because I think already when we're talking about AI avatars, it has a legacy around deep fakes and mistrust. And so for that reason, at this stage, you can't just say whatever you want to say with a Synthesia video. And so we have a content moderation system that has both a human component and also there's an automatic moderation system and there's a human moderation system. And both work to make sure that the content that's being produced is instructional or informational, or that we're really weeding out the inappropriate stuff. As far as the data security and privacy, I'm certainly not an expert on this, but I know that this is another place where it's up to companies to safeguard and manage who has access to the avatars, who has access to that data. So, this is really a shout out to our IT folks. I know that we're SOC 2 compliant, which is a compliance standard where that says it specifies how organizations can safely manage customer data around security, availability, processing, and things like that, and confidentiality. So the short answer to this is in the safest way possible, by moderating what people are trying to produce with these AI avatars, because they are photorealistic people and there's this legacy of mistrust, but also by doing everything that we can on the security end to make sure that data is protected, that somebody's likeness is protected and not accessible to outside people. So there are gates along the way, but I think it's something that's incredibly important for any company that's in generative AI to address and not just open the floodgates, because we're still actively figuring out what this means for the average person to be able to create whatever kind of video and content that they want.
What challenges or limitations do you see in the current technology? You know, the current technology as it is at the moment, we talk to about where it's going, but the current technology, how do you plan to address those challenges and limitations in the future?
Yeah, so I think the current state, if you were to make a if you were to make a video with an AI avatar now, I think several things that you notice is that is the framing. The way that avatars are generated is very limiting to what type of content you want to create. So the frame right now is kind of as you see me, and I'm kind of scrunched over in my chair a little bit, but it's from the top of your head. The camera angle is shot directly head on to the avatar and not from the side or other places. So this is essentially like working with a single fixed lens camera on a tripod that is not moving. And so I think the challenges or the limitations for the current tech is we have people who have different use cases from everything ranging from chatbots to training videos to commercials to news broadcasts to full-on narrative videos. And they're all trying to squeeze the most out of this single type of framing. And so I think that's one of the technological limitations that we have in the current moment. And one way that we plan to address that is, you know, I think I mentioned this at the very beginning, or hopefully I did, but the vision of Synthesia is to have Hollywood videos in a browser. You should be able to make the video that you want using avatar, you know, without cameras, without microphones or actors, from any angles you want. And so we just released, the wonderful folks we have in R&D just released an amazing study where they're working on volumetric capture. And that's just a big word for, we're looking, instead of just creating the head-on model, we're looking to capture the entire body in three dimensions. And what that'll allow you to do is you could then create whatever type of camera framing or shot that you want to capture. So, you know, if you want that two camera angle, you could have the first shot head on, and then the next camera angle, you'll be able to, again, you won't need a second camera, but you can get that that side angle shot where it looks like somebody's speaking to a producer. You could start to mimic those things that we see in everyday video production. So I think that's coming down the way. The research has just been released, which means that it's coming to our product. It's just a matter of time. So that's one technological limitation for the use. I think the other one is more of maybe what I'll call like an educational and ethical people limitation to the use. One that I struggle with, being from customer education and product education, is that the average person, it's easy for them to create a video just by typing in their text, but they don't know how to put together a story or put together a video. And so, or even direct another human being on camera. And so what this looks like in its current state is that you can go into Synthesia and you can say, when the narrator talks about the importance of diversity in the workplace, you can right now click on a micro gesture button that says like, I want this person to nod their head yes, up and down. And it's funny to see there are, you know, you could do that before or after any word in the sentence, but the average person is, I will have them nod their head three times and then they hit generate video. And the video that comes out is the avatar just unnaturally, in a very non-immersive way, you know, nodding their head 500 times, when it's just like, okay, you actually don't know how to direct another human being. And so therefore you don't know how to make a good video. So there's an educational part of, whether it's a people limitation or a product limitation part of how to teach people to make video, the average person isn't quite there yet. So there's this education barrier or product barrier of trying to get folks to use features well, learn how to put together a video, and learn how to tell a story in a way that's useful, impactful, and my goal, immersive.
How are you going to do that? Is that you're going to build it into the product, or is it going to be a kind of side service?
So this is my, I guess this is one, my one opportunity in this episode to really shout out the other part that I really work on and I'm passionate about, which is Synthesia Academy, which is teaching folks how to use the product, you know, from clicking around to the different features. But what I found is that you could teach people to use all these features, but they're still producing videos that are, should we say, not so great. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done where I'm, you know, working with people who are not creators to think, you know, even the first question you should ask is, you have this idea, should it even be a video? In a training context, a lot of what you need to create could just be an email, a PDF, you know, a job aid. It doesn't need to be a video. So it's helping people think through all the way from, should this be a video, to helping them make choices about, your script says this, and this is how you can visually represent it. Oh yeah, and you need a call to action to drive behavior change at the end of your video if you want to make it useful. So it's really helping people think about not just video literacy, but also video and training literacy. So that's Synthesia Academy. Hopefully you can check that out off the Synthesia Academy website as well.
Really interesting answer. I mean, it can be like this podcast sounds, episode sounds a little bit like a product advert, but
you're right.
You're such an interesting company. What you're doing, you know, 30% of the company you told me is dedicated to R&D, and your R&D is in a really important emerging area that people in R&D really need to know about. Lastly, because unfortunately we have to draw it to a close, we could go on for a lot longer.
All day.
Can you tell us kind of where people can follow you? Maybe some also hints about where you go to get your knowledge and what you follow and you think is valuable.
Sure. So if you want to get in touch, please reach out on LinkedIn. You'll just find me under Kevin Allister in what should be a serious profile picture, but instead it isn't. So you can't miss it there. You could also find me at, if you want to check out some of our Synthesia Academy content, at synthesia.io/academy to, if you want to start learning how to put together video or AI video. People who I'm following right now, you know, I think I'm following a bunch of different folks. The ones to shout out, you know, depending on what you're trying to get done. Maybe you want to be inspired about what is possible with generative AI. A great person to follow is this wonderful creator, Karen Cheng, who, you know, her shtick is that she kind of creates these, what looks like high production videos, something that would take a team of 30, 50 people to do. She creates it all herself using an iPhone and generative AI tools. So Karen Cheng is a person to follow. And then another person who's kind of is an advisor to Synthesia, who's making big waves in terms of talking about what is the impact of generative AI, is Nina Schick. And maybe we can put her name in the show notes as well. But
could you give me links in show notes? Because I'm going to follow them up anyway.
Yeah. She's another person who has been banging on the generative AI drum and what the implications are, going from ethics to the impact on business and the way we live our lives, all the way. And in the past few months, she is, you know, talking and touring all over the world right now and really having a nice big moment. But those are, you know, I'll keep it small, that those are two people who are really making waves in the generative AI space, Karen Cheng and Nina Schick.
So thanks a lot for taking your time today, Kevin. It's been a really great conversation for me. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me, John. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Hi, it's Kate Fitzgerald, Head of Fact. That's all on the Learning Hack podcast for this time. Many thanks to our guest and to our sponsors and to Synthesia for locking us in a broom cupboard while their avatars took over the front part of the show.
Wow, it was dark in that broom cupboard.
Yes, and the duct tape hurt my wrists.
But luckily, we're pros.
The Learning Hack is completely independent and transparently funded by sponsorship and your Patreon contributions. If you want to help others find us, please like, follow, rate, review, and subscribe on your podcast platform of choice or on YouTube. And you can contribute at patreon.com/learninghack.
Next time, normal service is resumed, but we'll continue to keep our beady eyes on AI just for you.
Stay human, learning people.
I finally get it.